Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name is Paul Manick. I am the Courier's political editor, and I am joined once again from our fine reporters from across the DCT politics portfolio in Dundee. Not with me, not physically, but in spirit, I have Derek Healy, the Courier's political reporter. We have in London, Dana Donoghue, the Press and Journal's Westminster correspondent. In Edinburgh, we have Callum Ross, the Press and Journal's investigations editor, and Adele Merson joins us from Aberdeen, and she is, of course, the Evening Express's political correspondent. Good morning, all.
Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
So, we've got quite a tight ship today. We have a lot to talk about, a lot has happened, a lot is coming up. Least of all, it is only 5 weeks to Christmas. That's right, you have only 5 Fridays to Christmas. We'll talk about that a little bit near the end of the programme. But first off, we had yet another wonderful Boris Johnson gaffe. This time it was on devolution, and Dan is going to talk us through what Boris has done this time. Dan.
Yeah, it's been very difficult to escape this story this week. It's, of course, Boris Johnson and another gaffe on Scotland. It came on Monday evening. Boris was holding a Zoom call with a bunch of Northern English Tories who've kind of branded themselves the Northern Research Group. And he was kind of talking about English devolution. And in the context of that, he said, you know, look north of the border. It's been an absolute disaster. And he said it was Tony Blair's biggest mistake. Now, you know, you ask most people to say something about Tony Blair, they'll talk about Iraq. So to kind of say it's his biggest mistake in that context is quite a claim. Unsurprisingly, you know, this has caused a huge backlash, you know, from the SNP, from Labour. You know, it's just an unhelpful remark, especially as we're going into next year, and obviously there's Holyrood elections coming down the track. You know, as I say, a lot of frustrated Scots Tories in private, at least anyway, at those comments. They won't help Douglas Ross at all, I don't think.
I mean, Douglas Ross came out almost straight away and said that he disagreed that devolution was a mistake. And you know, privately, I was contacted by a few MSPs. I'm sure you were the same, who sort of just voiced their disdain that this could happen yet again. Just it appears as we get closer and closer to the May elections, especially for the members of the Scottish Parliament and those hoping to run in May, that just how much of an impact Boris and these mistakes or these slips cost them in opinion polls and cost them in terms of support, even amongst people who would be tended to support the Scottish Conservatives, if not so much the UK party. But it wasn't the only thing that Johnson has had to put up with this week, is it? I mean, he's had to self-isolate, and he also has lost two of his closest advisors, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we had that extraordinary picture of, you know, Dominic Cummins, who's been kind of ever-present this last year as a figure in Downing Street, walking out the front door with his box of belongings. You know, he's finally gone too far on an issue, it seems. I think it all centred around Lee Kane, who is this other kind of faceless figure in Downing Street, who was the Director of Communications, and also Dominic Cummins' right-hand man at the Vote Leave campaign during the Brexit referendum. Kane seemingly was given his marching orders by Boris Johnson's fiancée, Carrie Symonds. She wasn't a big fan of his. And Cummins tried to kind of stick his neck out and get Kane to stay, and it didn't work out, and subsequently both of them have now left. You know, in their place, people might know the name Allegra Stratton. She's a kind of a former BBC journalist, ITV correspondent as well. She's kind of moved in now as a press secretary to Boris, and certainly, I mean, we had our first kind of briefing with her the other day over the phone, and she's kind of wanting to take a very different tone to that was taken under Lee Kane. I mean, for example, last year, there was a huge attack launched on the media by Number 10, saying that, you know, the public had lost trust in, you know, British newspapers and their coverage of politics. which was, you know, quite an extraordinary attack to come from an official Downing Street source. Allegra is very quick to apologise for that and try and move the conversation on and say, you know, look, it's a new era, basically. So, I mean, whether this improves Boris's ratings in Scotland is yet to be seen. You know, as I say, he made this, you know, error on Monday after all this drama had happened with Dominic Cummings. So I don't really know if he's changed at all.
And this is the same Dominic Cummings that refused to resign after he undermined the public health message for taking a quick trip up to Durham and back to see if his eyes still worked. Darren, you worked with these two chaps, or are people close to these guys? I assume down in Westminster, you are the correspondent responsible for joining a lot of these sort of off record or sort of spokesperson briefings. How big an impact will their leaving be on things like the lobby and how the government is perceived in the media for the next wee while?
Well, you know, I mean, it certainly represents a kind of shift in strategy. I mean, there's been a lot of Tory MPs who've said they would like to see more of Boris Johnson as he was when he was London mayor. This kind of, you know, bit more liberal, bit more cuddly kind of character who, you know, the nation, well, maybe not Scotland, but a lot of people kind of, you know, liked him back then. He's viewed as more of a comedy character. And, you know, particularly during the Brexit referendum and subsequently over the last couple of years, you know, his popularity has gone through the floor. You know, and that was one of the first things Allegra Stratton allegedly said to him, that, you know, you used to be the most popular politician in Britain and, you know, now look where you are. So it seems that they want to kind of take it back to, you know, how he used to be in a way. I mean, I don't really know how easy that will be, but I think the bigger change will be the fact that they're going to start having these lobby briefings televised from, I think it's in a couple of weeks' time. They're still just kind of soundproofing. It's in a basement, basically, underneath number 11 Downing Street that they're going to have these lobby briefings in. So they're soundproofing it all at the moment, and Allegra's going to take these on a daily basis in the afternoon. So I think that'll be positive in a way, because I think it'll open up to the public and the public will be able to see, you know, often, you know, journalists get accused of kind of, you know, who's the source, where have you got this from, you're just spinning things and all the rest of it. But I think it'll help, you know, when people can see themselves, you know, how we try and press these officials and get actual answers and details. And, you know, very, very rarely they're forthcoming with any information. So I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how that pans out over the next couple of months.
Okay, televised press conferences can, of course, be a double-edged sword, as anyone in the Scottish media will tell you about the First Minister's briefings. Thanks for that, Dan. That's some insight into stuff that you rarely get to see and know. And certainly when the story broke, it did seem at first as if it was a bit of a bubble story, but it obviously has a very large impact on how the country is going to operate over the next wee while. And moving on, in Holyrood this week, we had further discussion and learned more about the upcoming hate crime bill, which has been controversial to say the least. Adele, you have been following this particularly closely since its inception, really, and following its movements through the Scottish Parliament. Can you give us a bit of an update as to what has happened this week with the hate crime bill?
Yeah, so as you say, the hate crime bill, it's working its way now through Parliament. It's at stage two, which is where the people on the Justice Committee, the MSPs on the Justice Committee, are taking sort of oral evidence from witnesses on the bill. So witnesses are any sort of organisations that have expressed an interest in this piece of legislation. So just a brief kind of get everyone back up to speed. But currently in Scotland, the offence of stirring up hatred only offers protection in respect of race. But under this new laws, basically, this will be expanded to include like a whole host of new groups such as age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, and variation in sex characteristics. So as a result of this legislation, if draft legislation is made into law, then the bill would criminalise threatening or abusive comments that are intended to stir up hatred. So that would be, you know, if you make a comment with the intention that you would offend, say, somebody based on their sexual orientation, you could in theory be prosecuted under this bill. So this week the committee heard from a range of different groups, but I guess the kind of standout interaction was on the issue of transgender identity. There's obviously, it's becoming a very polarised debate in general. The committee heard from Lucy Hunter-Blackburn. She works at a policy analysis group which does quite a lot on women's rights called Murray Blackburn McKenzie. And she was basically saying that it's difficult to legislate in this area because there is no social consensus yet. So because you've got this debate, she thinks it is problematic to bring in laws when, as it stands, there isn't really that clear agreement on the overall issue. Also on the committee was Becky Kaufman of the Scottish Trans Alliance, and she was sort of making the point that, you know, there's very clear statistics out there that show hate crime is really underreported, and that what has been in the media and over this bill is kind of creating like a bit of a bogeyman, when really she doesn't believe that freedom of expression is under threat. And she's saying that it's absurd to suggest that these laws would have that impact in Scotland. So it's getting very interesting because, you know, Lucy Hunter-Blackburn was making the point that we have to be very clear on this in terms of, you know, you need to be clear on what is hateful speech and what constitutes abusive speech, or this could just become quite a nightmare, really, if you don't have these kind of clear definitions on issues such as this.
Because, I mean, that's what bodies like the police have been saying, isn't it? Is it up to them to decide what intent was? You know, did you intend to cause offence by making these statements? And, you know, have they really, you know, stirred up abuse? And it's all quite subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's where people that have raised concerns about this bill are concerned that we need to have very strict definitions. And some people argue, you know, abusive can be a subjective term. You know, what is abusive to one person might not be abusive to another person. So I think as the bill goes forward, there have already been, you know, amendments, as you suggest there. You know, it's changed from being, originally the bill was intent and likelihood, which meant that if you were likely to stir up hatred against a group, you could also be prosecuted. Now, obviously, the problem with that was people argued, well, that means lots of people could get prosecuted and have, even though they hadn't intended to offend anyone, hadn't intended to stir up hatred, they could find themselves, you know, on the wrong side of the law. So the Justice Secretary changed it to be intent only, which has been welcomed by pretty much sort of every side in this argument. But yeah, going forward, the Justice Secretary has said that he will have to look at strengthening those freedom of speech protections, because there is still, you know, a lot of concern around this and the sort of how subjective it still is.
And do you know if there's a lot of scope to do that with the bill being in its second stage at Parliament? Is there still plenty of time, and is there still the capability of making appropriate changes if deemed necessary?
Yeah, I mean, the Conservative MSPs on the committee, they've suggested with everything that's going on, they wanted the bill to be scrapped entirely, which obviously isn't happening. But they made the point that you've got coronavirus, you've got Brexit, you've got a very sort of packed parliamentary schedule, and that legislation that has this significant an impact, there should be longer to basically scrutinize it. So they have raised concerns in that regard. But as far as it stands at the moment, it seems like this is kind of all steam ahead. They're wanting it through in this sort of parliament. So it does seem like there will be still significant amendments to come, but it's just a case of how quickly that can all sort of come together.
Now, Callum, you've been covering a story which seems to crop up quite frequently, regarding threats to regimental names and titles in the army in Scotland. And this week it seemed, certainly at the start, that it looked like the Black Watch could be in for yet more trouble. Can you talk us through a bit what's happened with that and whether or not the name of the Black Watch is going to be consigned to history?
Yeah, that's right, Paul. It's obviously a story that will have been familiar to many, because as we know, the Black Watch has survived a number of threats to its future in recent years. This time seemed a little different. However, I mean, the whole process was kind of truncated and seemed to, in the end, sort of raise more questions than answers. In previous years, kind of reports have leaked from the MOD suggesting they were considering scrapping famous Scottish battalions such as the Black Watch or the Highlanders or others. And, you know, campaigns would get up and running, and within a few weeks or months, it would be announced that the Black Watch had been saved, but that maybe some other kind of unit would be lost or another barracks would be closed to make the necessary savings. You know, a cynic might speculate that proposing to axe the Black Watch and then saving them has been used in the past as a kind of cover to make other controversial decisions in effect in terms of the military. But this week seemed a bit different. And I'm still a bit confused by it all, to be honest. This week it emerged in a story on The Sun on Monday that the Black Watch was once again under threat. And the MOD certainly wasn't rubbishing the story when I spoke to them on Monday. It seemed odd in the first place, because anyone with, you know, I don't need to tell you guys, but anyone with one eye on Scottish politics, given the rise in support for independence, knows that it would be pretty unwise politically for the UK government to be considering any kind of move like that at the moment. But, you know, that seemed to be what was being suggested. And then, you know, before the campaign to save the Black Watch, the latest campaign to save the Black Watch had got off the ground, you know, it barely got off the ground by Thursday. And then Boris Johnson told the Commons that there would, in fact, be no threat to the battalion's future. He did that as he kind of announced a £16.5 billion uplift in defence spending over the next 4 years. What I find kind of strange is you would think that that proposal to for a major new investment in defence spending would have been known on Monday by whoever leaked the story that the Black Watch was under threat. So I'm not sure why it came out, whether the MOD, someone at the MOD put it out to, you know, get a bit of leverage and get that deal over the line with the Treasury or Number 10, or whether it was a trap for the SNB and other opponents, you know, who obviously immediately condemned the threat to the Black Watch, or if it's something else entirely. I mean, I should point out, I have no idea where that story in The Sun came from, someone somewhere obviously put it out there, and we don't really know how genuine the threat to the Black Watch was, but they seem to be okay again. They live to fight another day.
All a bit of skullduggery, which seems to be in keeping with certainly this week's topic of unknown spinning. Now, Derek, you've been following with much enthusiasm, I should say, the arrangements for Christmas, lockdown, Christmas bubbles or Christmas baubles, and the announcement of further vaccine success across the globe. It does seem that with swathes of the country heading into tier 4 today, and the rest of us remaining in the tiers that we were in before, that it was the same old, same old. And then news of more vaccines came out, and it looked like Christmas could indeed be saved in the next 5 weeks. Derek, is that the general take that we can have? Can we look forward to Christmas with our families?
I mean, I think to some extent, I think things are still very much up in the air when it comes to Christmas. But we have been told that we should have some concrete answers on this hopefully next week, which would be good given, you know, Christmas is 5 weeks away now, so it's probably about time we had some concrete thoughts on what's going to actually happen. I asked Nicola Sturgeon at our daily briefing on Wednesday what her reaction was to reports that we could see a 5-day loosening of household mixing starting on Christmas Eve. And she spoke about her determination to allow families to see their loved ones at Christmas, including possibly some that they aren't able to see at the moment. But she said she wants to do that in a way where it doesn't mean she's going to be standing up in late January and reporting large numbers of deaths from infections caught over that festive break. I also spoke to Stephen Riker from St Andrews University, and he suggested ministers could reach a sort of informal agreement or social contract with the public, where more mixing is allowed, but it's conditional on a greater focus on household hygiene. We know part of the planning on this and the discussions that are being held is based in the fear that if people feel that the measures are too restrictive, they could just patch the whole thing and end up having, you know, large celebrations across multiple households. Professor Riker believed that by loosening those restrictions but improving the setup in homes, from opening windows, keeping our distance and so on, we could actually increase compliance and reduce transmission. And Nicola Sturgeon has said that she too thinks it's better to treat people as adults rather than kind of leave them with restrictions that are too tight to follow. But, you know, the discussions are still ongoing. We heard that earlier this week there was a Four Nations call between Nicola Sturgeon, the other First Ministers, and Michael Gove, where all of this was being discussed. There's been nothing really further come out about that since. But we also heard that First Minister's questions on Thursday, Ruth Davidson asked whether people should be preparing themselves now for a January shutdown if rules are relaxed. And I think that's probably a very serious question that needs to be answered. The UK government's medical advisor on COVID, Susan Hopkins, said this week that for every day measures are relaxed, 5 days of tougher controls will be needed. So suppose, you know, these Four Nations discussions are going to come down to whether those 5 days with our families and friends is worth potentially nearly a month in lockdown, really.
January, of course, is a particularly tough time for the health service. Mm-hmm. Dan, what's the picture down south? Obviously, we have the same but different going on quite a lot with our lockdowns and our restrictions. Any indication that this Four Nations approach could be agreed upon before the Christmas period?
Well, I mean, you know, I know that discussions have been ongoing between, you know, the UK government and the devolved administrations. No kind of agreement has been reached as of yet. But, you know, there is hope and optimism. You know, of course, you've got a lot of people who live, you know, whether it's in London or cross-border, who want to kind of travel back home for that festive period. I mean, there's a lot of talk down here at the moment because, well, we're due to come out of national lockdown in England early December and then go back to this kind of tiered approach. There's been some talk of kind of allowing almost like a 5 day window for people to kind of travel around at Christmas. But then it's coming with kind of a caveat of after those 5 days of Christmas, we're going to go back into another month long lockdown. So some people have been kind of kicking back at that and saying, you know, isn't that kind of counterproductive? But I mean, obviously, Christmas is a very important time for a lot of people. So I don't know, a lot of it is still very much up in the air. And, you know, a lot of it really is kind of dependent on the science and where the R number is at the time. But I mean, certainly, I think, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, constitutional politics will take one, you know, take a back seat on this one. And you know, whatever political colour you are, you'll come together and try and work out a plan so as many people as possible can see their loved ones over the festive period.
And Derek, we mentioned earlier as well that there's been further success with the vaccine trials.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, it looks as if it may not be soon enough to have a major impact on Christmas this year. But we've now got two vaccines which have over 90% effectiveness in stage 3 clinical trials. And the hope is that at least one of those could be available this year. So the plan is that 1 million Scots will be vaccinated by the end of January, and every person over the age of 18 will get the jab by late spring or early summer next year. The first delivery of doses is expected in the first week of December. We're looking at around 320,000 arriving by the end of this year. The Scottish Government is basically planning on the basis that at least one vaccine will be given a licence in the coming weeks, and the assumption is that the Pfizer vaccine, the Pfizer candidate, will be available first. That's the one that has a 90% effectiveness. The problem with that is that the properties of the Pfizer vaccine, coupled with the sort of pressure to produce lots and lots of jabs as quickly as possible, kind of adds to the complexity of delivering the vaccination programme, particularly in Scotland. Because of the need to get these out there as quickly as possible, the early versions that we see, particularly this year, they won't be the sort of, you know, the pre-filled vaccine injections we might have seen previously with other vaccines, but instead it's going to come in a box with 195 multi-dose vials, or around 975 doses, and it then has to be split up. Some people will already be aware that the vaccine lasts around 6 months when it's stored at minus 75 degrees. That was a kind of the information that was put out there quite early on. But we had a briefing with some of the Scottish Government scientific advisors yesterday, and they were telling us that at a normal fridge temperature, that window reduces to just 5 days. And at room temperature, which is needed for the actual vaccination, there's just a 2-hour expiry time. So the real puzzle of that is, you know, is going to be, how do you make that work in rural areas where you might not be doing that many vaccines in one go, or you may have to spread it out across quite a wide area with a small number of people. And there are also further issues. We don't know how many people will need to be vaccinated before things return to normal. Both of the candidate vaccines we have from Pfizer and Moderna, they require two doses 28 days apart. So that would need to be tracked as well, presumably by, you know, the NHS or the Scottish Government or someone. And also, no one under 18 can get this vaccine because clinical trials on children and young people have only just started. And it then may need to be repeated kind of multiple times. I think Jean Freeman kind of described this when she was announcing this to the Scottish Parliament as one of the biggest civilian logistical challenges of our lifetime. And I think that's probably a pretty fair assessment of how difficult this is going to be.
Well, there we are. That's a brief glimpse of a Christmas miracle. Let's just hope that actually things can come together. Of course, we will be following the story every step of the way and making sure that the right levers are pulled at the right time. On that note, I will say thank you to Derek, Dan, Callum and Adele. I've been Paul Malik, and you've been listening to The Stooshy. We will see you same time, same place next week. Goodbye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day online and in print to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.